I want to look at what Sangharakshita has to say about the nature of reality. It's actually what the Buddha had to say about the nature of reality, and Sangharakshita translating that for us. And in this book, the chapter that I'm going to be looking at is called The Texture of Reality. The Texture of Reality. Probably I'm not going to be able to go through everything in the chapter, and it might be that we carry on next week exploring this. But the first thing that Sangharakshita says is that reality is not a Buddhist word. There's no equivalent. Sorry about that. Come in. There's no equivalent Buddhist word for reality. Reality is a rather abstract notion. And Buddhism doesn't tend to go in for abstract notions. Buddhism's very, very concerned with our experience, our real lived experience, what we do about that experience. It's not particularly a philosophy, Buddhism. It's a method. It's a set of teachings and techniques to help transform our experience, our lives, our minds, particularly. Whereas reality is quite an abstract notion that philosophers might use. Nevertheless, there isn't perhaps another word in English that quite captures what Buddhism is talking about. Because Buddhism isn't just concerned about us becoming me, you, becoming more happy, although that's part of it. Buddhism is concerned with us recognizing, realizing the way things are, the truth of what's going on. In fact, the central premise is that because us unenlightened ones are deluded to the real nature of what's going on, we live these cramped, limited, unsatisfactory lives. If we could see the truth of what's going on, there'd be an immense liberation and an outpouring of energy, of freedom, of bliss, of joy, of love, of compassion, and we'd live to our full potential. And the Buddha figure represents that potential personified. But nevertheless, I'm going to use this word reality. The other thing that Sangharakshita talks about is he's called this chapter The Texture of Reality, and he says he quite likes the word texture because it implies that there's a real tangible kind of experience that you can have of reality. Texture is such a concrete, tangible word, or the connotations of it are. So in Buddhism, if we're going to use this word reality, there are two realities, not one, but two realities. Later on, I'll talk about how those two realities are, or I'll try and talk about how they're related. And arguably, some schools of Buddhism would say that actually they're not really distinct. But in order to get to that point, you have to start from the premise that there are two realities. And the two realities, in Sanskrit, the words are Sanskrita and Asanskrita. And Sanskrita is sometimes translated as compounded or conditioned or made up. It's sometimes, well, one teacher I was reading recently translates it as fabricated. Fabricated gives you this connotation of something put together and therefore made up, but it also gives you this connotation that it's illusory. It's a fabrication. And that's quite a good translation, I think, of this word Sanskrita. It's often translated as conditioned reality, this conditioned realm. Because as we've been exploring this class, in this conditioned realm, everything that you can ever experience through your senses is arising not in its own right. It doesn't exist separately. It's part of a network of conditions. Everything is a conditioned phenomena and can be broken down into those conditions. You know, you take a book like this book, we call it a book, but actually it's a whole network of conditions that have come together, including physical conditions like the paper was once trees or wood. Then there's all the binding and all the sort of publishing work that goes into making a book. There's the fact that Sangharakshita wrote the material that is in this book. It was edited by somebody else. Sangharakshita is a Buddhist teacher because of a whole network of conditions to do with his life, to do with, well, part of that was that he had other Buddhist teachers. He learned from other Buddhist teachers. So you've got a network of conditions going back in history. He was drafted in the Second World War and sent to India as a signalman and was able to find Buddhist teachers in India. Had the Second World War not happened, well, I don't know whether Sangharakshita would have been Sangharakshita. I don't know what he would have been and whether we would be here today. There's a whole historical and geographical network of conditions behind any phenomena, such as a book like this. And of course, I could go on and on. In the end, you could say that the whole universe needs to exist for this book to exist. That means the whole cosmos, the Big Bang, and everything that's happened, as it were, since, is implicated in this phenomena that we so sort of glibly call a book. Yeah, and that's true of everything in our phenomenal world. Everything is the result of a network of conditions coming together. That's us, every material thing around us, everything that you can possibly experience through the senses is part of this network of conditions. That's a very different way of looking at the world, rather than thinking in terms of things. You think in terms of a network of conditions that we're part of. Yeah? That's very different. So that's the conditioned realm or conditioned reality. But then Buddhism says that that's not all that there is. That's not all that there is. There's also a realm that the Buddha talked about called the Asankrita, which is the unconditioned. So the unfabricated, the uncompounded, the unmade, there's a reality beyond this phenomenal world that is not dependent on conditions at all. It's outside, if you like, that conditioned structure. It's outside of this realm of matter and form. It's also outside the realm of, well, it's outside the realm of the senses, any of the five senses, anything that you can experience with the five senses, that's not the unconditioned. It's also outside what we normally call consciousness. So it's not within our normal, at least our normal experience of consciousness. That's not it either. So anything that the normal conscious mind and our five senses experience, that's not the unconditioned. It's easier to say what it isn't. Yeah? It's not even in space and time. normally when we think of a realm or reality, somewhere in our mind we're thinking of a place. But space and time are part of conditioned reality. In fact, Buddhism goes so far as to say that they're mind-made. They're constructs from consciousness. So the unconditioned isn't part of this framework of space and time, of form, of self or other. And therefore, it's outside of all conceptual designation. Yeah. And yet, the Buddha said that there is such a place. Such a place? That's maybe giving the wrong... you see, any language that one uses, I'm using metaphors, and those metaphors are... they belong to the world of space and time and things. So when we start talking about the unconditioned, even to say the unconditioned is to imply that it's a thing or a place or a state, and it's none of those. So that's weird, really, really weird, yeah? It's a very, very paradoxical, profound thing that is being pointed to. And yet it's said that that is what we have as our true potential. That's what will liberate us. So you've got this conditioned and this unconditioned realm. And the Buddha, in one of the suttas, Bhante talks about this, Sangharakshita talks about this, it's called the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. And in that sutta, the Buddha talks about, before he was a Buddha, before he was enlightened, what made him go on this quest for enlightenment, for realization, for liberation. And in this sutta, he doesn't talk about the four sights. He doesn't talk about going out of the palace and seeing an old man or a sick man or a corpse or a holy man. What he says is that he's just reflecting on his own experience, and he's reflecting that his own experience is finite and impermanent. All around him, he sees that everything is subject to decay, death, it's impermanent. And he says to himself, why if I am subject to death, am I going in quest of things that are also perishable? It's an interesting way of looking at the sort of life that I was talking about in the tea break. Why, if we know that we're mortal, that we're finite, are we looking for satisfaction, ultimate satisfaction, in other things that are also mortal and finite? He says, what would it be like if I went in quest of the immortal, the infinite, if you like, the completely fulfilling? What would it be like if I went for that as my refuge, as my quest? That's said to be the noble quest. And Bhante talks about that sort of reflection being the essence of the Dharma life, of any spiritual life. He says that it boils down to the conditioned in search of the unconditioned. That's what you could say the Buddhist life is. It's the conditioned, that's me and you, in search of the unconditioned. In a theistic tradition, I guess what you'd be in quest for is God, or union with God, or meeting God, or whatever. You'd be in quest for something higher, like a creator God. The thing is that, from a Buddhist perspective, God's not the answer, because God is still, particularly if you think of a creator God, a personal creator God, if that's your notion of God. And I know that the notion of God is so broad and elastic that you know, people can... I've met people whose notions of God, to me, seem thoroughly Buddhist. But if I take a classic notion of a creator, personal creator God, then such a figure is also in the realm of subject and object and space and time. He's in the realm, she is in the realm of, from a Buddhist perspective, of the conditioned. All you've done is you've imagined the biggest, brightest, shiniest, best object that you can. But you're still in this dualistic realm of self and other, of subject and object. And that isn't the ultimate aim of Buddhism. Yeah. That's not enlightenment. So, in a way, Buddhism starts from this position that there are these two realities and you can move from the conditioned to the unconditioned. Let me just pause there and see if there's any questions, particularly if anything I've said isn't clear. Does that feel clear?
No. The
yeah, how do you know? In a certain sense, you can't know. You can't know for sure until you've glimpsed or tasted it, touched it. Until you've really touched and tasted what it is, you probably can't know for sure. So then it becomes, Buddhism doesn't promote blind belief. Or sort of blind faith. It doesn't say you must believe because somebody tells you so, even if that somebody happens to be the Buddha. So what Buddhism is more saying is look at your own experience as you try and practice the Dharma and put more of it into effect. Does your life feel more fulfilled, expansive, rich, free, creative, joyous, connected with others? Do you feel that that's happening? Now, if you feel that that's happening, you're already orientating your life towards this goal of the unconditioned. You might not be able to see that goal or know even that it's there, but you're from the Buddha's perspective, you're orientating your life already in that way. And in a certain sense, you could remain agnostic about whether the unconditioned is a reality or not. You could just be quite pragmatic and say, I'll just carry on taking the next step, as I was saying, and see if the next step leads me to greater fulfillment, greater liberation, greater freedom, greater creativity, greater connection, greater aliveness. If it does, then take that step and, you know, keep taking the next one. But that's one way of answering the question, which is slightly evasive, isn't it? It's sort of saying you can't know, but keep going, and one day you might. That's one way of answering it, or not answering it. Another thing that occurs to me, though, is that we do have intuitions that there is something more. All human beings have that, actually. Now, I know that it isn't proved, because an intuition could be wrong, but there are moments in your life, sometimes they feel like they've just descended upon you for no reason, but probably we've got moments in our life of heightened experience, of heightened awareness, where our mind, we enter into a state of mind which feels bigger, more expansive and spacious than it normally does. Does that ring true for you? Sometimes those moments are connected with beauty. You know, they can happen in nature or through art. Sometimes they happen through being in love, and suddenly everything looks brighter. Sometimes people experience them through drugs and mind-altering substances. sometimes they seem to happen to you for no reason at all. A friend of mine had a sort of glimpse, I would say, of the unconditioned lying in the bath after a very, very stressful period in his life. And there was a lot of strain in his life. He was in the army and he was potentially going to be drafted into the Iraq War, the first Gulf War, I think. And there was a lot of strain and stress. And then one evening he's lying in the bath and suddenly, for no apparent reason, he'd never meditated before, don't think he was knew anything about Buddhism, he found himself in a state of mind where he was sort of outside his normal frame of reference and everything seemed connected and beautiful and all right. And that wasn't a delusional state. He knew that he was somehow seeing the truth more clearly than his normal everyday state. So that's quite a dramatic glimpse. Not everybody has such a dramatic glimpse. But those moments, sometimes they're just very, very fleeting, but those moments where you can have an intuition or a glimpse that there's something more to consciousness, to experience, than your everyday mind normally sees, those are pointing to something real. And I think lots and lots of people have them, but they don't know what to do with them. So maybe they dismiss them, maybe they don't talk about them, maybe they secretly cherish them as high points in their life, but they don't then make anything of them. Yeah. Does that help?
Yeah. I was also just thinking, is a few weeks ago heard about the One Noble Truth.
Mm.
Feels like that's, is that part of it? Is that like the idea that there's always suffering?
Mm.
That's, it feels like that's part of this other sort of reality of knowing truth outside of this one.
Yeah, no, you're spot on there, and I'm going to go on to talk about that. So, yeah, no, that's right. So you don't have to take it on blind faith, but look at your own experience, particularly look at whether you've had intuitions, glimpses, glimmers of something more, and also look at your experience since you've been practicing meditation and Buddhism. Has that experience changed you for the better? If so, perhaps there's more to discover. You know, keep taking the next step and exploring. So let me move on. So the unconditioned is pretty difficult to talk about for all the reasons that I've already said. It's difficult to picture, to describe, because anything that you can say about it falsifies it. But the conditioned is easier to talk about, and the Buddha tended to talk more about the conditioned. He tended to talk about this level of reality that we ordinarily experience. And he said that the conditioned, any conditioned experience, bears the hallmarks of three characteristics. These three kind of characteristics are like hallmarks. They're like stamps that underlie any experience of the conditioned. You can tell that it's conditioned rather than unconditioned if one of these three, or maybe more than one of these three, is found. So does anybody know what these three characteristics are? You had one of them just now.
The idea that there's always suffering.
Mm. That there's unsatisfactoriness in the conditioned. So that's maybe the one I'll explore the most today. Perhaps the only one that I'll explore. But for completeness, and sort of thinking ahead, does anybody know what the other two are? Yes, who said that? Oliver. impermanence. So that's the other characteristic, that there is only change. Yeah, that everything in this conditioned realm is changing all the time, that there's nothing static that can be found in it. Yeah, impermanence. Yeah, and the third? It's perhaps a bit more tricky, the third one.
No self.
Yeah. Can you say any more than that about it?
That nothing has a sort of an underlying essence to it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's no substance or essence to anything in the conditioned realm. It's sometimes called, translated as insubstantiality. There's no real abiding substance behind anything. So if I take the book again, you know, it looks like a substantial, tangible thing. But, you know, you could rip it up. You could rip out the pages. And then, well, is it still the book? If I rip out, how many pages do I need to rip out before it's not a book, for example? Or if I were to set fire to it, there wouldn't be anything recognisable left that we would call book. There's no essential substance here. It's just a network of conditions that have brought this phenomena into being, and it's always changing, it's always impermanent. Now, it looks like it might be quite static, but that's because it's changing quite slowly compared to most, you know, things that we're familiar with. But, you know, it's already dog-eared, it's bent, it's every time I touch it, it's changing. Even if I don't touch it, it'll be changing. The atoms that make up the sort of texture of the pages, they're moving all the time. There's nothing static about any of them. Yeah. Anyway, yes, insubstantiality. Perhaps we'll explore that more next week. That's the third lakshana, as it's called, or the characteristic, the three characteristics or the three marks of conditioned existence are unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and insubstantiality. But I just want to come to the first one. Do you know the Sanskrit word for this? In unsatisfactoriness? Dukkha. So sometimes dukkha is translated as suffering. Unsatisfactoriness probably is closer to what it means. It's trying to say that everything in conditioned existence is unsatisfactory. So is that your experience? Do you really feel that? Or is the Buddha just being a bit of a pessimist? Is Buddhism just got a bit of a downer on life? And saying that there's no joy to be had. Yes?
I think the answer has to be subtle, in the sense that it's only through the moments of radiance in daily life that we can gain intimation that there might be something beyond it. So that there are glancing moments,
yeah,
as you were saying, of something,
yeah,
very extraordinary,
yeah,
not to be discounted as a sort of,
yeah,
gateway.
Yeah. Yeah.
But obviously they don't last, but that doesn't mean that they are.
That they're not real. And so I think that's right, that from the perspective of the enlightened mind, where what we consider those glancing moments of radiance, beautifully put, if that is the experience of the enlightened mind all the time, from that perspective, that mind's perspective, the Buddha's perspective, what we are normally experiencing is, in comparison, pretty unsatisfactory. Yeah. Even our moments of bliss and happiness, compared to that experience, are pretty unsatisfactory. So that's one way of looking at this. I think it's a good way of looking at this. Yeah. So it's a relative kind of truth, isn't it? Any other thoughts, though, on this notion of unsatisfactory? Is that... why might the Buddha have said that? I mean, is that true? Yes.
Well, the minute we've got it, we want to keep it.
Yeah. And what happens?
It doesn't last forever.
Yeah, it doesn't last forever. So one of the hallmarks, as we've just said, of reality is impermanence, that nothing is fixed and therefore nothing can last. And what we want is the moment we got it, as you say, if it's fulfilling and pleasurable and satisfying at all, we want to hold on to it. And that can be possessions, more often it's people. You know, with a possession, at least it looks like it's not changing. with another human being, we're onto hiding for nothing, aren't we? If we want to fix somebody and hold on to them in a way that it's just not realistic. As soon as we've got something that is pleasurable, we want to kind of hold on to it. Somewhere in our minds, even if it's not that conscious, there must be a subtle kind of anxiety that it could go, it could disappear. Bhante gives quite a number of examples. He quotes a Buddhist translator and scholar called Edward Comza, who was saying that Comza uses the example of people who are really, really wealthy. And how they can be subtly anxious about losing their wealth, rather than just relaxed in it. The more you have, the more you've got to lose. And very wealthy people can be really tight, uptight and anxious about losing it. Somewhere they must know, do you see what I mean? That it's not a stable, enduring state. Yeah. Konzo also goes on to... talk about other forms of suffering that the Buddha talked about. So the Buddha talks about birth being unsatisfactory and painful. Birth is painful for the mother, but also it's said to be painful for the child being born. I don't know what it was like when I was born, but presumably I was quite comfortable and cosy in the womb. And then I'm pretty certain that I still hanker after the duvet. Do you know what I mean? I pull the duvet off my head, and that must be this yearning for this kind of warm, womb-like kind of state. And then we were thrust forth into this, you know, we didn't ask to be born. And then suddenly you're in this glaring lights and cold and noisy kind of world. Probably quite a traumatic experience that we started off this life with. Probably. Might have been different. Anyway, birth is painful. The Buddha talked about birth being painful. He talked about old age as being painful. You know, you start to lose the faculties. You become more and more dependent on others. Your body starts to decay and break down. And it's physically and psychologically painful, old age. Anyway, there you go. and then there's along the way, there's probably sickness, isn't there? So that doesn't help. He was just kind of drawing these different kind of... And then there's death. You know, death, even if you're ready to die, like, a lot of people die unwillingly, as it were, but some people, are fortunate enough to feel... they're ready to go, they're happy enough to let go. That's great. But probably there's still some physical discomfort. probably, yeah? And certainly death is probably painful for the ones left behind, the loved ones left behind. If you're bereaved, that's painful. It's a death. Yeah. And then the Buddha went on and talked about things like, even if you've got what you want, it's just what you said, you can be fear, you can be frightened of losing it. And sometimes you get what you don't want, sometimes you don't get what you do want, etc., etc. There's, life is shot through, human life is shot through with unsatisfactoriness. That's not to say that pain is all there is. There's also joy and pleasure and beauty and bliss and all sorts of things, love. But they are transient. Konza goes on to talk about how even when we're really happy and we've got everything we want, if you pause long enough and think about it, often our pleasure is sort of bought at the expense of somebody else's pain. Somebody else might have had to suffer for the things that make me happy. Labour for them, etc., etc. Sounds a bit sobering, isn't it? Do you want more reasons to be unhappy? Let's have a look. Yeah, another one he says is that something can be pleasant, but it's inextricably tied to something that is unpleasant. So the example he gives is, this is the Buddha talking, but the Konza gives the example of the body. So the body can be immensely pleasurable, and you've got all these senses and sense experiences that can be joyous and pleasurable. But inextricably linked with that is the potential for sickness, old age, and death. And all that, you know, goes along with that. And a lot of the time, the body doesn't feel very pleasurable, does it? Think about early in the morning, unless you can bounce out of bed. It's just not very pleasant to have a body, is it? So, so it's inextricably tied, the pleasant and the unpleasant in that example. Now, all of that would be not very helpful. All of this dwelling on dukkha wouldn't be very helpful unless there was a way out of that. Yeah, unless there was a way out of that. And the Buddha talked. One of the things he said was that all of his teaching boiled down to the teaching of dukkha and the ending of dukkha. That's what he was teaching. He was saying, life is unsatisfactory. Look at it and then orientate yourself towards something that is going to really fulfill, that is going to meet the deepest yearnings of the human heart, that nothing in conditioned existence is going to be able to do. Nothing finite, impermanent is going to be able to do. So he was saying that there is the possibility of the ending of dukkha. And that's the second noble truth, that it can, and the third noble truth, that it can be transcended. Yeah. So let me just pause and see if there are any more questions before I go on to what it might be like to transcend dukkha. Are you more convinced unsatisfactoriness being a hallmark characteristic of conditioned existence? Yeah? You all look pretty glum, so that's... So, one of the teachings around this is that when you really see the truth of unsatisfactoriness of dukkha, or indeed of the other two characteristics, when you really see, not just intellectually, but with the whole of your being and with the eye of wisdom, when you really see conditioned existence and the truth of conditioned existence and what it is, that is you seeing the unconditioned. So in this particular way of looking at this, the conditioned and the unconditioned aren't ultimately separate. If you penetrate deep enough into the truth of what the conditioned world is like, you arrive at an experience of the unconditioned. That's why it's so emphasized that you really reflect on your experience of the conditioned. That if we could really see unsatisfactoriness, if we could really see it, we would, and we see it with wisdom, we would have a turning about in our experience, in our consciousness, where there would be a letting go. There would be a letting go of trying to make life work according to the ego's desires. There would be a surrendering of desire, of wanting to fix life, of wanting to get it just right for me. If we could really see that the whole show is shot through with it's set up in a way that will never deliver complete satisfaction, if we could really let go of the grasping that we tend to live our lives by, there would be a release. And in that release, there's a glimpse of the unconditioned. And then what happens is that the yearning that for satisfaction is finally fulfilled, but not through getting what we kind of thought we wanted, but through transcending the whole framework of me wanting anything. Yeah? So that's quite a subtle teaching here, that if you go far enough in the conditioned, you arrive at the unconditioned. The sort of model, the spatial kind of metaphor, is that the conditioned is within the unconditioned. So if you go deep enough into the conditioned, you arrive at the unconditioned. And so each of these three characteristics, these three lakshanas, is associated with an experience of the unconditioned. If you go deep enough into unsatisfactoriness, you have an experience of a heightened consciousness called a samadhi, and this particular samadhi is called the apranahita samadhi. The apranahita samadhi is pointing to a state of mind where there is no wanting. There is complete contentment. There's this, you've let go of any grasping. There's nothing that you need or want. You just feel completely fulfilled. Completely fulfilled. So there's no pull or push. There's just complete serenity, contentment, fulfillment, and peace in a certain sense. There's a sort of resting. There's a, as it were, a sigh of profound relief at just being able to rest without the hankering, without the constant yearning that drives life on. It's sometimes called the unhankered samadhi. And it's not just contentment that we might experience after a good meal. Although maybe that's an intimation of it, it's a profound existential contentment where you see that there was never anything that you needed. You've got it all. That life was always perfect. Through all its ups and downs, at another level, it was perfect. It's just that we didn't have the eyes to see that. That's an experience. It's a mystical experience. It doesn't make rational sense. It doesn't make rational sense because from the unenlightened perspective, of course life isn't perfect. How can we even say that when there's so much pain and suffering? But from this transcendent perspective, without denying the suffering, at the same time, it's fine. It's fine. And that's a mystical experience, not a rational one. It's seen through with wisdom. It's apranahita. So that's said to be a doorway to liberation. It's said to be a gateway to liberation. You reflect on dukkha, on unsatisfactoriness, and you arrive at complete fulfillment through letting go. Letting go of all wanting, of all yearning. So it's very, very paradoxical, because the instinct is to grasp after what we want rather than to let go. Yeah. Yeah.
This kind of the sense of letting go of kind of hankering and wanting, I just wonder how and where ambition kind of fits into that in terms of there's certain kinds of hankering to kind of accomplish things and kind of hit certain milestones or kind of do something significant with your life. I wonder how that kind of fits in with that. Again, seems slightly paradoxical to kind of think, well, actually, I could just let go and just not try to achieve anything because I've got what I need.
Yeah. It's a really good question because you're completely right that for us, unenlightened people, there will be a hankering, and some hankering isn't bad because it might lead to progress. If we prematurely, in the spiritual life, just let go and say there's nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to be, if we just do that, well, probably we'll never get out of bed in the morning and never do anything and not make progress. So that isn't what's been got at. There's something about ambition or that drive to succeed which can be quite healthy. It depends where the ambition's oriented. If the ambition is oriented towards just having more and being more yourself, then it's just one more fuel, one more bit of fuel on this conditioned wheel. It's just driving this conditioned realm. But the ambition could be directed towards wanting something really fulfilling. And in a certain sense, it's the same sort of drive, but it's directed towards something positive, something that might actually fulfill. So there is a place for ambition, particularly in the early stages of the Dharma life. And by early stages, I mean like decades. There's probably a place for striving, for wanting to become more fulfilled. You know, just to meditate, you've got to have some sort of sense that it'll work and that it's worth doing. So there is a place for that. It's just look for where is your ambition oriented? Where's it going? And is it working where it's heading? Yeah. So you're right, you don't want to let go prematurely. Yeah. Just one more. Maybe I'll come to you as well. Go on.
Mystical experience. I mean, if you can have this mystical experience, but it's still a subjective experience. So what about other people? I mean, how can you then help other people if you're so inclined?
Yeah.
If you're altruistic.
Yeah.
I mean, you still have a problem.
Yeah. So There's two things there that I want to try and touch on, but I haven't got very much time. The first is that I talked about mystical experience, but actually an experience of the condition of the unconditioned isn't really an experience at all. It's not even like a mystical experience, because, as you say, any experience implies a subjective thing, and an experience of the unconditioned, you've left behind the notion of a me, of a subject, as distinct from the object. You've left anything behind. So, in a sense, you can't talk about the unconditioned as being something that I experience, like any other experience. It's again, we're at the edges of language here. So, although I was talking about mystical experiences as intimations of something more, the unconditioned, you wouldn't be able to really categorize as an experience that I have. Then the other thing that you quite rightly raise is, what about other people? What about other people? And this goes to the heart of the Buddha's experience after his enlightenment. Because what he experienced was that he transcended dukkha, at least all emotional, mental dukkha. He still had a body, and the body was still subject to decay and pain. But any psychological, emotional, mental dukkha to do with the mind, he transcended. But then, that's not enough, because you look around, and other people haven't transcended that. So then what's said to arise in the enlightened mind is compassion. What's said to arise is this sort of boundless compassion for all unenlightened beings. For everybody that's trapped in this conditioned realm, there's just this yearning to free them all. And so what the Buddha did was to live out of that compassion by teaching the Dharma, helping to free as many people as he could, and starting, well, a whole lineage of teachings that, you know, is still alive today. The work is never done, because there's always more suffering. There's always more suffering beings. So it's paradoxical to think that you can sort of ever rest or retire as an enlightened being. You might be free of suffering, and then there's just a sense of compassion that arises. And that's said to arise quite naturally, because one of the characteristics of the enlightened consciousness is that you've transcended all sense of boundaries and separateness. Ultimately, you see that you are not separate from other beings or from the rest of the universe, the rest of phenomena. And so when you recognize that you're not separate, you can't help but feel love, empathy, and compassion. Maybe that's a good note to end on. So the Buddhist quest to be fulfilled isn't just about individual personal enlightenment, as if there was some sort of goodie for me to be had. It's a bigger thing than that. Next week, I think David Mitra will carry on looking at these three marks of conditioned existence. He'll look at impermanence, he'll look at insubstantiality, and carry on seeing how they're doorways to this realm of the unconditioned. Good. Thank you very much.